What's up, everybody? Welcome back into another episode of Cult Film Cafe. Of course, it is me, one of your hosts, Jonathan, and as always, I'm joined by my partner in crime, Kenzie.
Hello there.
So, yeah, another one off the list here today. We will be taking a look at 2002's comedy horror starring the one and only Bruce Campbell. It is Bubba Ho-Tep.
How could I have gone from the king of rock and roll to this old guy in a rest home?
You were an Elvis impersonator.
You fell off a stage and broke your hip? Who was it? 20 years ago.
That's where they took a piece of my brain. I got a little bag of sand up there now.
Jack, President Kennedy was a white man.
They dyed me this color.
What we have here at Shady Rest is an Egyptian soul sucker of some sort.
Some kind of Bubba Ho-Tep.
You know, a mummy hiding out. Feeding on the sleeping.
He can just keep on feeding unless he's finally destroyed.
All right, man, let's go.
So yeah, this is a cult one, isn't it? It's on the beaten track of cultiness, this. I think you Google this and it's cult film, cult classic, cult film.
You take one look at this film, you already know it's a cult film. There's no other way about it, really, I feel like. Some films are just that obvious, this one's extremely obvious.
Yep, I agree. It's a strange one. I never really knew about this film, but not really a Bruce Campbell fan. I've never been an Evil Dead guy, so like, I think a lot of people get attached to him and his character. Yeah, and he also directed the film. He's also, just having a wee look at his filmography, the man behind, is it
Phantasm?
Phantasm, the Phantasm sequel trilogy, whatever.
I've never even heard of them.
Neither have I, but there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
And it looks like they're horror comedies, very much in the vein of a Sam Raimi. So maybe that's how there's a kind of lineage here, where Bruce Campbell's just attaching himself to these types of people.
Yeah, I don't really know how this kind of happened, how Bruce Campbell ended up on board with this. Like, it's a really low-budget film, but, like, well, is it, what, a million? I think it's about a million. But
what, this film?
Yeah.
$1 million.
So that's like, I mean, that's like saw budget. I don't know where, but I guess that just happens. I mean, Bruce Campbell as well. I mean, he's a B movie actor. He's so.
But he's like an A tier B movie actor.
An A B actor.
It's kind of weird, like, because I get where you're coming from. I wouldn't call him an A list celebrity, but he's upper echelon of the
B. He would call
B-tier.
Himself a B movie actor.
But that's good because he's got that a nice. He's not egotistical about himself,
no.
Which is funny. I wouldn't say this about Nicolas Cage, but the thing is Nicolas Cage will always be Nicolas Cage, and he'll always be a celebrity and a movie star and an actor. But he became this kind of parody of himself, which a lot of people are buying into now.
And he's had like a huge revival now.
And apparently there's some actual films that he's done in the last few years that have been actually quite good.
I've seen some of them, yeah.
Like, so I was getting a lift home last night from my brother-in-law Jamie's been on the podcast. He was on, so I think what episodes? Big Trouble?
Yeah.
Trainspotting?
Possibly.
I think both of them. No. It was him, Trainspotting and Goodfellas. I think he's been on three times. Anyway. We were talking about the FNAF film, because I brought it up, and because he'd Oh, side note, that's done massive box office numbers, like crazy.
I've not actually checked yet.
Done 130 million in its opening weekend worldwide.
Yeah.
Which is more than double what they predicted.
Yeah, they
thought. Because we were in here last week and there was like a story up, like an article. It was like 50 to 55 and it smashed it easily.
What's crazy about that is that for some reason they released it, so it came out on Peacock at the same time. Why? Surely that's just taking the budget, taking the profit down, surely, right? That's what I would have thought.
Aye.
Did they not think, did someone not think it was, that like a Hail Mary just in case it wasn't going to perform very well or what?
I don't think it's that, like, I get it, it's like an, as again, it is an IP film, but not in the same way as like a Exorcist film. So they would have bought the rights, but the creator of the game,
he still works in the, he worked in the film, yeah.
Yeah, he's been the biggest driver to get it like made. And I think the story is with Five Nights at Freddy's is somebody picked it up and then it got dropped. I think it might have been Universal or something, but then Blumhouse picked it up.
Which is the right place for it to be, I would say, probably.
So but they didn't have to spend an extortionate amount of money on it. Like they probably didn't have to pay to get the film, like the IP. They probably just had to put money in to get the film made.
$20 million they put into it. So.
But like, because we were talking about the animatronics, and he was like, Jamie was like, "Oh, it kind of reminds me of Willy's Wonderland, the Nicolas Cage film."
Yeah.
Which is why it came up in conversation, because we were talking about Nick Cage, and I've not seen Willy's Wonderland, but apparently it's about like arcade games that kind of come to life.
I've not seen it either, but when I remember when it came out and everyone was like, this is Nick Cage, Five Nights at Freddy's, where he like has sex with pinball machines. There's like some really weird thing about it where he's really erotic with the pinball machines that he plays. I don't really know. I've heard it's really weird, but some people kind of like it. Yeah. But Nicolas Cage chose it because there's very little dialogue and he thought it would be interesting to play a role that has not much dialogue.
Fucking hell, that's a bizarre take. I never knew what the film was about. I just kind of, the animatronic thing was brought up and I thought it was quite funny. But yeah, like, I would say that Nick Cage, as much as he is a probably an A-lister, but he is probably like, he's kind of sometimes a B-movie star because of the amount of movies he was pumping out that were just trash.
But he would just take anything. He doesn't like,
he just takes it, yeah.
He'll just take it. If it's if it does actually genuinely interest him, he'll just go on it. So that's why he's ended up in so many things. I think that's why he's grown so much and popular recently. And I think, that's also a reason why, like, he's quite popular with younger audiences now, Nicolas Cage. You'll find.
I mean, the thing is if you do enough films, surely some of them are going to hit. Like, you're going to get ones that are good. Like, there's no way you could do 20 films and them all be bad. I think, specifically him, he obviously knows what a good movie is. He has been in good films. He's had a storied career, but it was kind of strange for him not to be in the types of films that you would expect somebody like that to be in now.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, there's very definitive kinds of actors. You've got the actors that will just take everything. Like, Sam Jackson was like that for years. Like, he would be in anything.
Yeah.
And it was like they just wanted to act and be in productions. And then you've got actors which are more, they curate their career, and they are very selective in how they pick parts and who they work with, like Leonardo DiCaprio, for instance. And they're not really in the same conversation. But at a time, Nicolas Cage was thought of as a really, really good actor, not like a movie star. But obviously, his career's like when it's not even that. It's not even that long ago. Like late '80s, mid '90s, he was doing Oscar-nominated performances and stuff like that, winning Oscars, I think, potentially for leaving Las Vegas. I think. I think he was definitely nominated for it. But yeah, it's like he had the highs, like critically. It's just he obviously decided to go a different way, like in the sort of late noughties. And then into the,
he did go bankrupt at one point as well, I'm pretty sure.
I'm not aware of that. But anyway, that's enough about Nicolas Cage's career. Back to Bubba Hotep. This is wonderful. The podcast goes in some amazing tangents. Like, I just leave them all in now. I don't really care. It's quite a good conversation. People obviously enjoy listening to it. I think this makes a podcast. I mean, see, if you just speak about a film, like, this is what happens. It's kind of very generic, isn't it? Mm. It's better to have a back and forth conversation. But no, this film is kind of really strange. Bruce Campbell plays Elvis. Is he really Elvis? Or Sebastian Half is the character's name. He wakes up in a nursing home.
Mm.
It's a kind of strange start to the film. Like, he's having like a fever dream kind of thing.
Has him throughout the film.
He does have him throughout the film. And it's a very interesting way to open the film, and he's just in a, like, in a room. See, the more that this film went on, the more I could see, like, strands of Barton Fink meets Naked Lunch.
Yeah.
If you kind of amalgamate them together.
And you make a better film.
Well, I don't know which one of those three I would watch again.
Oh, definitely this one for me.
Oh, no, it's like, right, we know you're going to love this film, or do love this film. Only watched it once and thinks it's amazing. It's a classic Kenzie. Gave Five Nights at Freddy's 5 stars.
I actually didn't, but you know who did? Becca did give it on Letterboxd 5 stars to Five Nights at Freddy's. I could not believe it.
Right. Well, hot take, but I've not seen the film, so I can't comment on that. You have seen the film and you can have your own comment on it. I'm not attached to Five Nights at Freddy's franchise. I'm in the wrong demographic.
You missed it.
I missed whatever Five Nights at Freddy's was. But yeah, he wakes up, he's in a nursing home, and there's this kind of inner monologue. This is another thing that annoys me about the film. Like, we're just jumping about the inner monologue things. I don't know if I like it.
I like it.
See, I don't know if I'm into films like that, where there's like an inner monologue narration.
Mm.
Specifically, this film uses it a lot.
Yes.
And I wonder if that's like happenstance to a lower budget.
Probably.
Because just doing a voiceover, you get a lot more narrative out there for a lot less money. Because you're just telling
just
a story.
Do it all at once. You can do it. It's really easy to do.
Yeah. I mean, in this film, apart from like a few... Maybe there is only like one kind of action-y... I think the action or the narrative only moves to an actual physical other place when he's real Elvis and he goes to swap places.
Yeah.
Everything else is just visual. It's not part of the story, but everything else just takes place in the nursing home or in the outer grounds. Does it go anywhere else? Am I just making that up?
Yeah, Barb being on some like random roads and like a trailer, an empty kind of like trailer park kind of place. Yeah,
right, but that's where he goes to swap places. That's the whole narrative, yeah, that he is the real Elvis because he swapped places with the best Elvis impersonator in the world.
Yeah,
but when Elvis died, it wasn't really Elvis.
Mm.
Which, I mean, now you think about that out loud, it makes sense.
I thought it was such a, it was done really
it's
well.
It's a great concept because it does make you think, like, if you have somebody that can imitate you perfectly, then if you do get fed up with the fame and the fortune and the shit and you do swap places, how are they going to know it's real? Obviously, you could do like a DNA test and stuff like that. So there is ways that these people could maybe take him seriously. I think the problem is he wakes up from a coma or whatever he's in, and it's like he's really old, and it's like he's probably starting to lose the plot in their eyes, like going a bit senile.
I don't know.
So they probably don't take him serious at all.
So I don't know when he woke up from the coma.
But the problem is he starts going back to calling himself Sebastian Half towards the end of the film. So you can't. It kind of has this kind of blurred line. Is that there is a mix, but then the same happens with other character. It's the JFK character.
They dyed him black.
Ozzy Davis. Here, actually, on a side note, was at a gig last night, and I don't know how PC this is. You're allowed to be in Halloween, but you know where I'm going with this.
I'm not sure if I do.
I you do. Like you just preface somebody being dyed black.
Oh.
Do you know how there's like this story of Michael Jackson being bleached and all that stuff?
Yes.
Right. This is where I'm going. That gig, and this isn't in a pub or that. This is me standing outside waiting to go in to the venue, and there's these two young people, guy and girl. They might have been a couple, don't know. But they're dressed up for Halloween, and they probably went, we're going to a Halloween party, we're probably going out for a night out, but we're wanting to see some live music. They bought tickets to this, happens to be on Halloween. Gig finishes at like 11 o'clock. You can drink in Glasgow till like 3, 4 a.m.
Yeah.
I mean, and if you live there, go to a party, right? But the guy who's dressed up as like a vampire or something, can you guess what she was dressed up as? That would be potentially allowed on Halloween, but be potentially massively racist at the same time.
I have no idea. Wait, what?
She was a black cat. Oh. But instead of just painting her nose black and giving herself whiskers, she full black-faced.
Right.
She had a full black face.
Okay.
And I'm like, is that really allowed? You can tell that she's a black cat, but it's kind of like, should you be painting your whole face black?
I mean, for the context, I think it's fine.
But I think you can get away with letting people know you're a black cat by, like, whiskers, black nose, you know, some subtle touches. I don't think you need to buy in. You're not method acting here. You're not Daniel Day-Lewis and, like, Gangs of New York, like, getting wet and getting fucking whatever.
Some people are really dedicated to Halloween, though. You know,
I get it, but it's weird.
when I was a kid, we were doing face painting. This person was doing face painting. I asked to be a ninja. So I pretty much ended up pretty much blackface.
Right, Kenzie's outed himself. We are now getting cancelled. This is the last episode of the podcast. It has been nice knowing you, everybody. That is it. No, please don't cancel. He was only a child. He didn't know any better. But no, my personal thing is that's why I say it's probably, it is kind of acceptable because it's Halloween. But I think I think most people would maybe think about the implications. She was only young. She was probably a young lassie, but I think, like, especially somebody my age, I don't think I would get away with it. Because you would think about, like, you need to think about the world as a whole, like, in
I think
the culture.
When it comes to, like, animals and stuff like that, I think with that context, I think it's probably completely fine. If you're imitating people.
No, I get that, but it was just very strange to see. And it's also a very big commitment. Why the fuck would you want to paint your whole face black? It was like jet black. How are you getting that off in the morning as well?
It's Halloween. It's strange. People really put a lot of shit in for Halloween.
Oh, it's mad. Anyway, we're back off on a weird tangent. We're on Ozzie Davis's JFK, who is, he is black in the film. And he is JFK, but they put him in a different old man's body.
I can't tell if they put him in a different body or they dyed him black. Or something about his brain in sand. I can't remember what that was about.
He does not look like JFK.
No.
But he thinks he's... So he's got the... So the way it would be is like he's JFK's mind and somebody else. But I fuck knows how that... That one doesn't work as much as the Elvis one. Doesn't make a lot of sense.
And you don't know too much about the character as well. Like, he says a couple of things at certain points that makes you think, okay, maybe it actually is JFK. With Elvis, they put a lot more into it, so you saw where you see the whole what actually happened. It's actually done really well, whereas JFK, it's, I think for the most part, it's done for a kind of humor kind of sake.
It's funny. Like that part of the narrative, I quite like. It does make you think of it, you know, because it could have happened. I'm not speculating that it did. I don't believe that Elvis is alive somewhere in a nursing home or anywhere, do you know, but it kind of makes a bit of sense. And eventually this kind of, like, the narrative kind of descends into this kind of weird, wacky world with the oversized cockroaches and, like, you know, like...
And scarab beetles.
Or scarabs, because it's Egyptian mythology, good one, scarab beetles. It starts with this wee old lady who, like, she's just wandering about the nursing home. What a cunt. Stealing that woman's glasses that was in the iron lung. And she was like, oh no. So he's got a day in her and she's just smiling. She's stealing the sweeties and that. And I'm like, oh, you wee cunt, you're a wee cunt.
Oh, she dies anyway.
Well, lo and behold, the next scene she's like chomping away and then the scarab beetle. And she thinks she's beating it. And then we get to see Big Bubba.
Big Bubba, Hotep.
Who comes in soul sucks.
Oh, that's...
He's a soul sucker.
He sucks you through your ass.
Well, but it later you find out it can be through any orifice. Doesn't have to be your ass. But they made a whole kind of joke about it. It's kind of funny.
This is a really weird... I just got to kind of say, this film is very crude in its, like, language. But it's also, like, it's so weird. I think they handle everything in the film with, like, care. Like, it's like they actually... I think it's like... There's some kind of like heart and kind of nobleness to this film. Like, you think it, you hear the concept that it's like Mummy, Elvis is actually still alive, and JFK is black. You think that's the dumbest thing. It's gonna be super goofy, and yes, it is silly, and the language is very crude, but it has this like other side to it as well, which actually I think that puts some depth into like the characters and the development of them through the film, which I think was handled really well, which I actually quite liked a lot. I was not expecting.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem, because this is an adaptation, I'm not a massive reader and I haven't read the book, so it would be interesting to how the adaptation works for anybody that's fans. And it seems as though this film is well received for the most part.
Yeah.
So they've obviously done a really good job. It's obviously a really kind of, like, see when you think about a book that's like very imaginative like that, like,
yeah.
Elvis is alive, they swap places, and there's all this kind of fantasyful like mythology behind it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably a really good idea for a book. But when you think about it, it's probably a book that should have got adapted, and like I think it was done well. Like, I think it was probably done as a real close representation, and I think fans of the book probably really like the film. But it is an interesting concept. Doesn't quite work on one level with the JFK character. It really works in Elvis character. It's not really a lot of other characters. You only really see like who I think is the care home manager once. You've got the nurse who comes in,
yeah,
a couple times. The granddaughter appears. There's that kind of scene. It's the inner monologue problem. He's got this kind of weird opinion of himself. He's very self-deprecating.
Yeah.
For a lot of the time, and then he's got this kind of hero arc, like, because he's like eventually grows. And I suppose that when he puts on the white Elvis suit, he kind of becomes full,
yeah,
I'm a superhero. It is interesting. It's just weird how they've managed to draw out something that is actually quite an interesting film, not going to a lot of different places,
yeah,
only having really three or four characters that have any form of screen time.
Mm.
I mean, this is Bruce Campbell led for the most part.
Like, pretty much the
I mean, he,
and he's great, by the way. If you've not seen it, actually is really good in the film.
I'm not a Bruce Campbell stan. Like a lot of people, I've not watched him in a lot of things. Like I said, I've not even seen any of the Evil Dead films, so what he's most famous for. So it'd be interesting. Like, I need to watch Army of Darkness at some point for the podcast. Maybe I'll watch all three films at the same time just when I'm doing that. It's an interesting take. I don't think this film gets made unless Bruce Campbell's attached, which is weird. Maybe he wanted to get it done. There's maybe that.
I'm not sure who
story.
Else could do that kind of.
Neither
thing.
Am I.
He's like the perfect kind of person to do a role like this. He can handle the stupidness, and somehow brings like a thing you didn't really know that Bruce Campbell could do, bringing a bit more like actual kind of like somewhat seriousness to it. And yeah, this film, like, I thought I would like it, but this film actually quite surprised me with what it ended up being like. Also, I quite liked the music. That was one other thing I actually kind of liked throughout the film.
I was trying to work out what that song was.
Yeah, I really liked it.
It sounds like it's got a beat that's in a familiar song that I know.
Yeah.
But I couldn't work it out. It's interesting. It's so obviously in the story, like the narration in books, I don't think it matters as much because it's just. You're telling yourself a story that's on a page. I mean, somebody's written a story, you're reading it or to yourself in your mind.
But it'll be in the story we've written first.
It is, aye. So there's exposition in the short story that they kept in the film, like, for the most part. But I'm reading here that they found it difficult to integrate Elvis's voice. Mm. Like, so there's that. He does a good job. Like,
yeah.
I also think there's only a finite number of people that could play Elvis that could kind of look like him.
Yeah.
And he is one of them.
He is one of them, yeah.
Because he's meant to be old Elvis.
Yeah.
And it's funny when you see the flashback and he's Sebastian Half. He's playing both characters.
Yeah.
But the one thing that struck me is he goes into a room to see Sebastian Half.
Yeah.
Who's eating like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, I think, or pie. No, it's pie. It's pie. He's got like blueberry on his lip, and he's like starstruck because his idols walked into the room. And they obviously, you don't get to hear them strike a deal because it kind of cuts back to the outside. But you kind of know what's happened. But there's a very distinct, different look between them because Elvis, when he, the Elvis character, is a bit chubby. But Sebastian Haft's like Bruce Campbell, like size. But when he leaves the room, how do his entourage not know it's another person? I know he looks pretty much identical, but he's not like like for like.
It's your, it's the subject, like, you know.
You've got to let that part of your brain go away. Like, you've got to suspend your disbelief, so they
it's
say.
It's not the type of film that you should be
uber critical about. Yeah, like, I get what you're saying, but
you'll probably break
it stood out to me.
I mean, yeah, fair enough.
It did actually stand out to me. That's why I'm bringing it up. Because I'm like, because the Sebastian Haft character looked about 10 years younger than the, what age Elvis was meant to be in the sort of mid-70s, I'm guessing that was the time when this was... Because it was when Elvis was done with fame because his wife had left him and like the money wasn't worth, like, it wasn't worth it anymore. And which he kind of has that kind of outburst. Like, and the Elvis film that we watched last year, Baz Luhrmann's, there is that side to the Elvis arc where he does go through this kind of self-loathing phase, like before he realizes just how much he's been bled dry by people, you know. And well, it's
we watched that this year, I think, by the way.
Well, we done it for the Oscars.
Yeah.
Okay. So this year, last year, it came out last year, I think.
Oh no, absolutely came out last year. Yeah.
But 2022 is Elvis, the Baz Luhrmann one. But it's quite interesting. You see the same narrative, like Elvis is such an iconic figure that even in a short story they're still capturing like parts of his personality, and even though it's in this kind of fantasy world, it's so believable, and I think that's what makes it good. Now I'm not saying I love this film, but there is parts of it that I really really appreciate.
It's like done well. It is genuinely
done well.
Like you wouldn't expect like a film like this low budget, but like so many things about it, like I think it's acted well enough, shot well enough, and I think the dialogue's really good in this film. And yeah, I was just surprised by, because I was expected to be kind of fun, shit, goofy, and I think it's a genuine good film.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, I suppose it depends on. It depends on what you want out of a film.
This will definitely not be for everyone.
No, absolutely. It's a genre that, I mean, if you like the genre, I suppose you'll probably really like this film. If you don't...
It's not a lot like it, though, I'll say that.
That's what I'm saying, is like, I feel as though, for somebody like me, I've not watched a lot of films like this,
I don't even know what you'd have to look for to find a film that's similar to this. It is quite different. Because you might go here like, oh, I want to see like a kind of mummy film. We've hardly talked about the mummy in this film, but that's because, to be honest, the mummy's not a huge part of the film.
No, he's kind of like, there's parts throughout the narrative where he's like slowly introduced and you see kind of figures, and it's not until like...
The final act.
The kind of final act where they've sussed out and they're going to have a showdown where you can kind of see him, and there's the, well, in fact, before that, there's the part with the gun guy.
The gun guy.
Who, he's obviously got soul sucked.
Yeah.
It's a silly thing to say, but...
Like I said...
But he's like walks, it's like... It's the part where Elvis and JFK are in JFK's room. What a plush room he's got,
yeah,
by the way.
He's got a mad room, eh?
Just a big single room by himself. He's got all the ding-dongs and sweeties and that. And but he peers out, like Elvis is peeking out the door, and then he's just, like, the big bubble hotel is just strolling down the hallway.
By the way, the mummy looks really cool.
It's like Lachlan at Halloween.
Do you know what? I could see it. That's my brother, by the way, just for anyone who doesn't...
Lachlan. He won't appear on the podcast, though. He's too much of a shitebag. Harangue him on Instagram. Find him. Find him.
On Instagram. I don't think he has on Instagram. But...
Find him. Get him on Facebook. I'll leak his Discord if you want it. Message me on Instagram. Force him on the podcast. No, actually, I did think about Lachlan and the cowboy... Bubble Hotepi guy, he was cutting about.
It's a cool outfit. It's like mixing two different kind of hangs.
It's like a Western meets...
Western meets kind of...
Meets a mummy.
Aye.
It was like cool. It was like a mummified cowboy.
For quite a low-budget film,
it does look good. I suppose that's practical effects coming back clutch. Because I think if you used special effects or CG back then, it would probably look really bad.
Yeah.
Whereas it actually, like, you can still watch a film like that and appreciate it.
Which, like, there is a little some effects that are like very, very basic, but I think it's just because it's not an effect heavy film. It's not like a big action film or something like that.
Things that I've got a gripe about is I don't like the exposition of it. Like, I'm not a big fan of like that much dialogue. Like, that's, and I guess that it's in the book, so it has to be in the film.
Right.
But it's not something I would personally put in a film, like loads of like expositional dialogue like that. But obviously, if you've got source material and it's in there, you've got to be faithful to it. Some of the edits are weird in this film.
Yeah.
There's, like, I think when I say to Ken, this is a comedy horror, and he's like, is it? And I'm like, well, it is. So I feel like there's some aspects of it that you will probably feature in similar genre.
Yeah.
So there'll be, like, things that are done in kind of, like, genre-specific. Apart from that, I don't necessarily think I have anything bad to say about it.
It's just preference, I think, for the whole thing.
Yeah, I think that's the problem. It's like a Marmite film.
Yeah.
You'll either love it or hate it.
Because it is made well, and I don't think there's really anything inherently wrong with the film. It's just, it is what it is, and you'll either really, probably really like it, or just think it's boring and not really get it at all. And when I was looking at the Letterboxd reviews, that's kind of what I was seeing. People loving it and people going like,
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know if I've got much more to say. It's a film that, it's pretty simple. It's done well. It's probably done by the right person. As much as I did say, if Sam Raimi done it, how would it be?
It's much more like kind of action-y packed, I think, and much more fast-paced.
Yeah.
I don't think he could have done this film.
Like this particular version of it. Which, by the sounds of it, is faithful to the novella, so maybe he wasn't the right man for the job.
I don't think he would have been.
And at this point, he was directing Spider-Man, so he was busy doing his thing.
True, it was the same year.
Same year, first Spider-Man came out, so he was doing his thing with Spider-Man, so yeah. What about you? You got anything to add to this portion? Like, just bits of the film that you like, dislike, don't like?
I particularly like the start of this film as it starts explaining what, like, all the stuff about Elvis, but I particularly really like the ending. Everything about the final act, how they handled with the characters and like how they came, like the development of through the film, they genuinely do have like genuine kind of character development that's just handled really well. Even respectable for like to like Elvis in a way and stuff like that. It's just done well, and then you get to the final part of the film and it just kind of ends there, but I really like that it's done that. I think it works really well as it just concludes and that is it. And I don't know. It's kind of like a character piece for these two characters. It's, yeah. I don't have much more to say than, I think this is a film of a lot of people probably haven't watched, and I think that's...
It's probably slipped under a lot of people's radars.
Yeah.
I'm just going to shout out Adam, who's been on the podcast. He did want to do this film, but sadly, he got picked.
At random.
But we've got plenty more. They can come on and do another one. But yeah, it must be one of those ones where there's probably pockets of groups of friends that all know the film, you know. And it's probably one of them that it has probably slipped under the radar of like a lot of people's viewing. Unless you're seeking out like films like this or really culty films, this would be in the list, and rightfully so. It's on a poster like this. It's one of these films where I firmly agree that it is a film that should be on the list.
You can't argue it.
It's just an argument you can't have, which is kind of funny because we're just about to go into the rules of the Cult Film Cafe, and we've just said that it's a cult film, so it's like, do we talk about that part of the podcast in a film like this? We probably should. It's probably not going to be that long.
It's good to see if it does hit some of the criteria.
It does hit some of the criteria, that's fine.
Show you most...
I mean, First one we talk about is low budget and box office flop. I mean, it's $1 million budget. It done 1.2 million, so I mean, it made its money back. But
was it even released in theaters?
I assume so. Yeah,
was it really? It was maybe like a limited thing, because it's
probably had a limited release.
Yeah,
I think the thing is, in with American cinema, it's kind of weird. Like, I listened to an American film podcast, and they talk about things like release things. So you'll have like limited release, so it might be in like two cities and two cinemas.
Yeah.
And it might be on like in 20 screens. And then it goes wider and wider and wider. But I'm guessing there'll be films where the wide release maybe never happens because it's not well received, or it's not making the money, so it's not worth putting it out there.
Yeah.
And also, you've got to remember that it's in the day where digital wasn't a thing. Well, it was a thing, but it was like infancy. Like, you think about producing multiple versions of a film using film. Like, see, like old school projector and stuff like that. Because every cinema would have to have their own copy of the movie.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So that would cost money and money and money and money. So it's whether something like that is worth it. So obviously when it goes into like a limited release, if it's not doing well then, is it ever going to do well enough to put in a wider release?
Yeah.
I mean, there's even films like in the last few years that maybe only do like, I don't know, a 500 screen and that's it. And then that'll be it gone. I mean, there's films even in the UK here, like where we're based in Scotland, that you see and a week later they're gone. Like that surprises me, specifically when there's not that many films coming out anymore. You get films that only run for like a week or two, and then they're totally, they're vanished. But then you'll get films like an Oppenheimer that'll run for like 12 weeks in the cinema. Obviously, they're like the amount of showings will decrease, but it runs like an Avatar. I mean, the only reason these films like an Avatar hit the money that they do is because they're in cinemas for months, months and months and months. Like, I'm pretty sure that when Titanic came out in 1997, it was in theatres for like 5 months or something.
Really?
Like 5 months.
That's a long time.
And I think it done a lot of rewatch, so there's a lot of people who probably went like four times to see it.
Yeah.
I mean, where else are they making that amount of money? I mean, you look at that amount of money in 1997, it was like $2 billion. And you're like, fuck. Like, and tickets were probably cheaper, I would assume. So I don't know what the inflation is in cinema. Well, we say that. I mean, it's cheaper now in Stirling to go go to the cinema than it's ever been, I think.
Yeah.
A wee cheeky fiver ticket. You can't get that in Falkirk, eh, bud?
The highest it went was £12. It's now went down by £2. However, when I went to see Killers of the Flower Moon, it was £11 and not £10. I don't know why.
Oh, a wee bump there, eh? a wee Marty bump.
I don't know if it was when I watched it, but no, surely not. I watched it on a Thursday.
But no, definitely low budget. Technically a flop. I mean, this isn't the type of film that's meant to go out there and make loads of money.
Yeah.
Like, this is the type of film that would come out now and be like a FNAF. Like, they would put money in it and, like, maybe a bit stranger, but that kind of way where, like, they've invested a wee bit of money, but they're not expecting it to do, like, 500 million. If it makes 50 million, they're happy, you know, in the first weekend or whatever. But, I mean, it's done more, like, maybe a different analogy, but there's probably films like that that come out where they're super low budget and they're coming out because they want people to see them more than they want to make loads of money. It just so happens that some of these low-budget films, specifically in the horror genre, come out and they're just surprise successes. Like, even Talk to Me, for instance. Like, nobody thought that it would do 90 million at the box office. There was probably a time where that film was probably going straight to streaming. It was probably never getting a box office, like an actual cinema release.
Yeah.
It might have done limited in Australia, maybe in America, or it might have done a limited run internationally for a week, but it's obviously, it was conceived probably as something to package for a streamer. And that just kind of goes to show you that you can have successes. Like, and not everything is going to be a success. Like, I think The Exorcist is a massive disappointment.
No, absolutely. But
they were expecting that to do loads of money, and it's kind of, I don't know if that's even still in the cinema. It probably shouldn't be. But anyway, yeah. So it
actually, didn't that do well? I thought The Exorcist done well.
What, The Believer?
Yeah.
I think it done as well. But you've got to remember, they paid $400 million just for the rights to the movie.
But there's no way in hell they expected to make that much. I mean, I was making three of them.
Look, but the thing is they think they spent like $50-plus million on it. It's not like a $2 million film.
Yeah, I know, they're not. It's high budget, especially for...
And see, that's the thing about the Halloween trilogy, like the David Gordon Green Halloween trilogy. Like, he only got to do a 2 and 3... Like, although he planned a trilogy, but he only made one, and that's why there's like a gap between them coming out. COVID's a thing, but the second and third one were filmed together, but they were, also the budget went up a lot more and the profits came down. Mm. So like the first Halloween done, there was $10 million. It's the best one of the three by far, and it done the most money by like 60-70 million.
Mm.
But because it done that, it gave him the license to go and do another two. Because they've already made the money.
Yeah.
So why not, like, do it, let them do the sequels? They probably shouldn't have let them do the sequels, but that's our opinion.
Yeah. 121 million is what Exorcist made.
How much did it cost?
30.
There's no way it only cost 30 million.
With the 400 million, how much million it was?
400 million.
To buy the thing, which is...
But that's just a figure. Wait, so... I wonder where they got that figure from, because they obviously bought it. Somebody gave them a figure. So you think about Netflix when they bought the next two Knives Out movies.
Yeah.
They paid like $450 for that. So there's obviously figures floating about for IP. It seems they must be in that range of, like, depending on how big the franchise is, predicates how much money they're willing to spend.
Yeah.
But the thing about Knives Out is it had a limited release in the cinema and it was a Netflix film. Where are they making the money from? But the Netflix model is getting people to watch it on the streaming service and making people want to spend the tenner every month continuously. They seem to have a model that works. That was another thing I listened to like on a podcast. It was like Netflix is the only one that's doing well because everything's sputtering. Like, because nobody's doing that. Like, the streaming model was great. But I think it's I think people are starting to see the flaws in it, whereas I think Netflix is kind of locked up.
Netflix was doing bad for quite a while. I think it's going up now, especially since they're cracking down on password sharing, which is, I think, the biggest thing.
Well, I think Netflix will survive whatever happens. But no. Rewatchability. I mean, this film's a swift hour, 25, 30 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, that's all you need to know. It's not long-winded or anything. It's very quick. You get the gist of the film really quickly. It doesn't take time to build. When you get thrust into the story, you kind of meet the character, you understand the Elvis narrative, and then very quickly you even get the Bubba Hotep narrative. They don't try and hide it from you. Although the actual ultimately getting to see him takes a bit of time, like in all flesh and glory, or all bones and glory. But you still get a sense of him from almost the get-go, because that the scene with the two wee old women and her in her room happened in the first, I don't know, 15-20 minutes.
Yeah,
probably quicker than that.
Yeah,
so I wasn't really keeping track of the time. Like, I was just, and then when it was ending, I was like, oh, it's ended. So yeah, I mean, I would say it's a rewatchable film, specifically if you like this genre. I'm not saying I will rewatch this film. It's not a genre that I like align to, but I can see Kenzie like watching this. I wouldn't say regularly, but I mean, I could see you putting it on like once a year, you know, like it's kind of that kind of film.
I feel like I'm definitely planning a rewatch of this film, but I don't know when.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not asking you to tell me when you're going to watch it, but the fact that you think it's rewatchable.
I want to revisit it.
I mean, I think it's rewatchable as well. It's just, yeah. I genuinely think the people, the fans of this film, are definitely going to feel that way.
Yeah.
Then we move on to, what do we want to talk about? Quotability?
Quotability, well, like I said, the dialogue's good. It actually is really, actually probably one of the strongest parts of the film. I don't think I've only watched it once, so for people like really big fans of the film, there's probably quite a few. When I was on Letterboxd, a lot of people kept on quoting two specific quotes. Actually, it might have been three. I took pictures of them. So one the main quote that I seen get quoted a lot on Letterboxd was, "Get old, you can't even cuss someone and have it bother them. Everything you do is either worthless or sadly amusing."
Yeah.
Which is actually a good line. And another one I heard was, that's when after he kills the cockroach, he goes, "Even a big bitch cockroach like you should know, never fuck with the king."
Never fuck with the king. Yeah, I mean, obviously, you would have to get something like that in there. It's there is some comic moments. It's like, it's the JFK part, and he's like, "No offense, Jack, but President Kennedy was a white man." It's like, I just like matter of fact, but it's like, and then it's like they dyed me this color. That's how clever they are. Mm. It's like daft. They're just dying people. But no, there's a lot of things about his pecker.
Pecker, yeah. I was just bringing
that
up.
He does a lot of pecker stuff, and then he eventually gets a. He gets a rager at some point. And it's quite funny. It's the smirk on his face. It is quite a funny film. Like I'll give it its due. There is moments where there is people that are going to actually really find this funny and a really good film. I think this happens quite early on. I don't. Maybe it doesn't. The quote about, "Is there finally and really anything to life other than food, shit, and sex?"
That's
maybe it's not early.
Sure,
it's just trying to work it out.
I think it is.
Because there's a lot of the existential stuff, the exposition stuff, where he's like speaking about him being young and like vibrant and youthful, and now he's just like a sack of shit in a bed, and he can't even get a hard on. That's his kind of initial mindset when the film opens. Like he just feels like useless.
Yeah.
Like a lot of old people probably do, and I think we'll touch upon that just in a minute or two when we get to the themes and stuff in the film. Not that they're going to be controversial, but they're quite interesting when you think about it. But no, I agree with you. I think the dialogue is good. There is some funny moments, and we're kind of hard because there's some films on here where I'll be right into and I'll watch like three times before I even think about recording. And there's films where it's like a one take and I've watched it once because I don't really fancy doing a rewatch. This is one where I maybe should have watched it a couple of times before, and you maybe could have picked out stuff. But I think it depends what you're looking for in your first watch. Are you just wanting to watch a film like as a consumer, or are you wanting to look for any technical elements that you like, or are you looking for acting that you like, or music, dialogue? It's really difficult to capture everything in one watch, you know, unless you're like critically trained to do so. But I mean, even still, there's a lot of critics out there that I'll probably consume a movie at least twice. They'll go and watch it as a consumer once, maybe take a notepad and write notes, and then they'll go back again and then they'll take concrete notes because they can look away from the screen now because they've already seen it, so they can start kind of working on a narrative and how they want to talk about it or write about it. That's what I found when I done my June one, as I went to the cinema once. I never took a notepad because I was like, I can't look away because I'll miss something. As much as I missed like the first 5 minutes of the film, which is another story, but I watched it twice before I even thought about writing about it. And then obviously I listened to the first part of the book. It's just, it gives you more context, I suppose. But no, quotability, I think there's going to be... did that actually... I'm just looking at quotes. This is cracking me up. Like, I watched this really, really late at night when I was in my bed. So maybe give me some due here. But apparently JFK, he had me on the floor and he had his mouth over my asshole. Elvis Presley, so he says, a shit eater. Fucking hell. This film's got some bizarre things in it, man. Yeah.
I'm surprised it even works, but it just does.
It does. It does work. Yeah. Anyway, so quotable, probably. There is probably ones. I think the more I read stuff, the more it's making me laugh and see that there is probably some one-liners in there that are actually really quite funny and amusing to say. But yeah, Moving on, not well received by contemporary critics stroke reviewers, next up. Like we said, this film's kind of Marmite, but for the most part, critically, like,
yeah, it is received very
it
well.
It is received very well. Like, Rotten Tomatoes is a 79%, both critically and audience score. It's a 6.9 on IMDb, so basically a 7 out of 10. And even on, like, Metacritic, like, it's average or mixed, like, reviewers, but it's a 7.4 audience score. I mean, RogerEbert.com, which is Roger Ebert's, the late great film critic's website, he actually reviewed it because he was still alive at the time, and October 17th, 2003, gave it 3 out of 4. So a very strong review. He obviously liked the film. And then Good Old Empire, which is the magazine I like to read, 3 out of 5. It seems as if it's like that across the board. It's like you're probably 3-4 star.
Three, four.
Unless you probably really like it and you could maybe get up a bit higher.
Yeah, a lot. You'll see that on things like Letterboxd a lot. You'll see quite high ones. Which I wouldn't even argue with them on that. I think that's fair if you do genuinely like the film a lot. But yeah, I think main reviews is like that it is received as well.
Yeah. Explores controversial topics, subjects, and themes. No,
no, not.
I mean, is it
getting old?
It's yeah. That's the kind of main factor in this for me is like reading about it. It's the aging and growing old in a culture that only values young.
Yeah,
and that is a big theme present throughout the film.
And it's done very well, actually. Actually,
I mean, because even when you think about the Egyptian mythology. Mm-hmm. That was their whole ethos.
Yeah.
It was like dying young and being preserved because they got all their organs like pulled out. And there's even some flashes of that in this film where you're ripping people's brains out their nose and stuff like that. It's kind of a weird, like, it's kind of a weird culture to align yourself with in this type of film. Mm. But it obviously works with the kind of themes and topics you wanted to discuss within the narrative because it is very sort of set in Egyptian mythology that it is all of these pharaohs and that when they take power are all young. Nobody's living to like, I mean some of them probably live quite old, but a lot of the famous ones, especially ones that I'm familiar with name wise, die really young.
They're really young, yeah.
And they're kinda like idolized in this way, you know. Obviously like, they get pyramids and stuff built for them, you know, they're gods among men, so to speak. But the way it captures it in this kind of weird, kooky, comedy, horror film is quite interesting.
I think they handle everything with taste. It's kind of crazy. I'm surprised.
I mean, there is some crassness to it, you know, yeah, like the jokes
like,
and stuff.
It's very
like,
crass.
Like
but
the dick jokes and stuff like that. And there's a lot of, there's some crudeness in it as well like when the young granddaughter comes in. But it's not over the top and it works in this genre of film. It's not out of place. That's
the
thing.
It's just mixed it really well.
It just works for some reason.
I don't know. I don't know how they've done it. A very well written script and just, I'm not too sure, but it just does work.
Yeah. Finally, we have the impact and legacy of the film, which actually surprisingly to me, the amount of articles that are like dedicated to this.
Really?
Whether it's like writing about cult films, I mean, there's an article from the Irish News, that's the 1st of November 2023, talking about it. Like, I just look, there's people write 20 years later, that obviously came out 2022, last year. They were celebrating it. And finally, there's a joke part at the end of the film.
Yeah, I missed that.
Right. So there's like this kind of ruse where they're like propping up a sequel.
Yes.
Called Baba Nosferatu, Curse of the She-Vampires, which was meant as a complete joke. But the writer actually and director actually changed his mind.
Because it was actually received.
Because it was received really well. And it was actually thought about it. They thought about centering it in a slightly earlier period, the Elvis, like 50s and 60s. And it was interesting because they would bring in Paul Giamatti to play Colonel Tom Parker, would have been quite an interesting take, because I quite like Paul Giamatti.
But I think Bruce Campbell left
yeah.
it.
Yeah, well...
In fact, he actually said... I saw a quote that he said he had to leave because they were getting... They were disagreeing on stuff, and he said it out of for just to keep their friendship that he left the project.
Aye, like in 2007, Bruce Campbell reported that he was no longer involved in the sequel.
Yeah.
And that him and the director had butted heads on a few points. And they couldn't reconcile apparently, so...
Honestly, I'm glad.
Yeah, it probably is a film that probably... I think the thing is it's probably done really well, and it's remained within the cult status because it's like a one and done.
Mm.
And it's... I think if there was more...
More.
You kind of risk making a shit film.
It wouldn't be this... What they were planning to do, which would... I just don't see how it would work.
I agree.
So... Yeah,
it's an interesting one, but I mean it's very very relevant, especially this time of year. I mean, we're just fresh off our spooktacular extravaganza episode where we spoke about five horror films essentially for Halloween. But I mean, this could have easily been a Halloween slash kind of film that in this kind of time of the year to watch. I think people probably do watch it this time of year, and it's probably interesting. Is like a lot of these like 20 year on, or like reviews of it, or like people still writing about it, are round about this time of year. So it's obviously a type of film that is more weighted to this time of year. But yeah, we will now move on and just decide, based on the conversation that we just had, is the film a cult film or not, and does it deserve its place in the top 100 list? Well, I mentioned earlier that It's one of the most cult films that have came up. I'm struggling to think of a more culty film.
Maybe Man Bites Dog.
Man Bites Dog, the mockumentary. It's kind of it straddles a different line, because it's like mockumentary and that's its own genre, I would say. But I mean, this is like an actual film, a narrative and stuff. Try to think what else. It was kind of interesting because Jamie was on the Big Trouble Little China episode, and they'd done a reference about it's more culty than the band The Cult. I can't remember what he said, but it was quite good. I quite liked it.
Oh, yeah, I remember what he said, yeah.
Aye, you mean you do have these films. I think Big Trouble's probably more known than this film.
Oh, absolutely.
But I can still understand why they're both cult films.
Yeah.
But no, like, this is one of them, like, the more on the cultier side of the films. And yeah, I mean, I'm guessing you just agree with that. I mean, unless you want to add anything.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It just is. It's like you can take one look at the poster and everything about it. It's just a cult film. It's like you can't. If there's someone saying that it's not, they're wrong. It's kind of simple as that. It's not a film that's commonly known. It's mainly known by Bruce Campbell fans because they're fans of like Evil Dead and stuff like that. So they go through and watch
things. I mean, that doesn't surprise me. I mean, I think if you were like an Evil Dead fan or a Bruce Campbell fan, you've probably seen this film already.
See, I've known about this film for years. I've just never watched it, but because I'm a fan of Bruce Campbell.
Yeah, and it's easily should be in a top 100 list, I think.
Oh, I'd have it in probably the 20s.
You would have it quite high. It's your kind of film, not for me, but I would definitely have it on a list, 100%. Especially based on the films that we've watched and just trying to think about it. Because even when we're not recording the podcast, me and Kenzie have conversations about... It's quite hard to name, like, just 100 films, I suppose.
That is hard, yeah.
But, yeah, we didn't rate the film.
We didn't. Do you want to rate it?
Well, I suppose we should rate it now. I'm just going to give it a solid 3 out of 5. I think that's fair. I'm not in the kind of camp of, I think it's a great film. There's things about it that I like. I spoke about it earlier. I mean, I like the portrayal of Elvis is really quite interesting. That kind of narrative's interesting. And, yeah... Bruce Campbell as Elvis is really quite good, and it is quite funny at parts. Like, even it had me laughing there just reading some of the dialogue. So give it its due. I mean, it done what it could with a relatively small budget. I just don't think people understand how little $1 million actually is feasibly trying to make a film, which is interesting, because listening to a podcast that I listened to, they were talking about the kind of doom and gloom of the writer's strike and just how unfairly they've been treated. But basically he's a writer and worked on productions, the guy that was talking, and he was like, they don't get paid. until something goes into a production. Mm. And I mean, your film's being distributed, writers very rarely don't care, or like the people involved, because they're getting paid at this point. There's money pumped in and it's going out to the market. It's like, but it's not unusual for writers to sit on a project and revise it for over a year and for it not to be picked up, and then they don't get anything out of it. They've basically wasted time and they're not getting any money. And I don't think that, like, it's very, very difficult to do a project for a little money. And he was saying that he's managed to do it because it's his team can do it, because there's a lot of them that work together. And they basically, he asks favours for people, which is where that becomes really risky, I suppose, in the industry, try to get somebody to do something as a favour rather than being paid what they should be. But aye, tight budget, really clever. Must be a really fun book to read if you're into reading. I would check it out if you are. But yeah, I would definitely recommend watching it. Even though I'm only a 3 out of 5. Still, I'm still highly recommend you give it a watch.
Because it is worth a watch. Even if you don't, I mean, some people won't like it, and that's, it's kind of niche. But for the people who like it, I think they'll really like it. It's one to check out. For me, I really like this. It's a really strong 4 for me. Like, I don't think I'd give it any higher than that at the moment. But it's a really like strong 4 for me. It's a really good film. I like pretty much everything about it. It surprised me. It was different from what I expected. I was expecting the mummy part to be a big part of the film, and it's all the Egyptian stuff kind of happens throughout and stuff like that. That kind of focuses on Elvis a lot and JFK and like the whole part of getting old, and it's handled really well. I don't think a lot of things. I was actually speaking about this the other day. About, I don't think a lot of films handle getting like aging very well in films and what it's like. And I was talking about how Trainspotting 2 does it really, really well. And I think this film does it completely different from how that done it, but also just handles it really well. And I was surprised. I kind of came out of it like, wow, that was. It's just not what I thought I was going there to see, but I was quite happy to see it. So yeah, and I mean, Bruce Campbell was great. I didn't really think about him for Elvis, but now that I've seen it, I was like, yep, that makes sense. And his performance really completely carries the film. The guy who plays JFK was also very good. I mean, there's not really anyone else in the film. So the fact that these two people can carry the film itself shows you.
No, basically, yeah, it's like Bruce Campbell and Ossie Davis is JFK and Elvis. I mean, there is probably shout out Bob Ivey, who plays Bubba Ho-Tip.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, they're the three narrative like drivers. I mean, there's some quibs with the hearse drivers, or like the the people that are kind of taking the bodies out. There's this kind of, every time somebody's get their soul sucked, the dead body just gets put in the back, and it's the same people. And it's quite, I think it becomes more and more of a caper the further it goes on. I think the last body ends up in the bush and they drop it. It's just quite funny. You've got, yeah, it kind of riffs on. It is kind of strange that obviously they couldn't. It's obviously simple, the source material, but they couldn't expand it out, you know. I think sometimes films that try and do too much are can be at fault of trying too much. That, I know that sounds like a counterintuitive thing, but sometimes simpler is better. And I think I sometimes try to even draw out a short film to a full film doesn't always work. Even if that's what you intentionally want to do, and you think, I'll make a short to try and get my film made, because if I do a short and people like it, I can make it. But sometimes you're maybe just better off leaving it. But yeah, that is it for this episode of the podcast. Thank you for listening. And yeah, if you like to go out and give us a wee follow and a like or whatever over on Instagram, we are at Cult Film Cafe. And if you follow us wherever you get your podcasts, we are at Cult Film Cafe, wherever you may find us. So yeah, it was an interesting one. And I actually pleasantly enjoyed the film for once, and a few episodes probably. So it's a goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me.
Podcast out.
Thank you very much.